Planes powered by GE Aerospace Technology take off every 2 seconds, and nearly 3 billion people flew last year with our technology under wing. As a new independently traded company on the New York Stock Exchange, our purpose remains: invent the future of flight, lift people up, and bring them home safely.
A dip in consumer spending adds to evidence of a slowdown in the U.S. economy. And Chevron reports record earnings as oil companies outperform other sectors. Plus, can drugs treat addiction? Programs at U.S. prisons and jails may have an answer.
Honestly, it's changed my life, to be completely honest. It really has. I couldn't get away from the drugs. I couldn't. But since I've been on this box, and I'm normal, me again.
It's Friday, January 27th. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that moved the world today. Consumer spending fell a seasonally adjusted 0.2% in December, according to the Commerce Department, the second straight monthly decline, after a streak of spending increases for several months last year. As spending dropped, so too did inflation. The latest data leaves the Federal Reserve on track to raise interest rates by a 0.25 percentage point next week at the central bank's first policy meeting of 2023. Big Oil continues to post big earnings. Chevron today reported a record $35.5 billion in profit last year, more than double the year before, as oil prices were pushed higher by a surge in demand and amid the war in Ukraine. Oil companies are outperforming other sectors like tech and finance, which have cut thousands of jobs in recent weeks. BuzzFeed shares jumped 85% today after doubling yesterday when the company announced plans to rely on the artificial intelligence startup OpenAI and its text generator ChatGPT to enhance its online quizzes. But our reporter Alexandra Bruel says some employees at the company, which in December made plans to cut about 12% of its workforce, are concerned about further cuts.
CEO Jonah Peretti, I've heard, has responded to each individual question, and his response is largely, the technology is here to assist content creators. It's here to help inspire ideas, but we need people to be able to use the technology to their benefit. So it's early days, but it is something that BuzzFeed is investing time and money in. You know, and in 15 years, Jonah Peretti has said he believes that this technology will, instead of being used to curate content on the internet, it's going to be used to create content.
In political news, Ronna McDaniel won her re-election bid today to lead the Republican National Committee. That comes after disappointing GOP performances in the last three election cycles and an intense fight over the seat. The win will make McDaniel the party's longest-serving chair in modern history. Officials in Memphis, Tennessee tonight plan to release videos, including body camera footage of the incident that led to the death of Tyree Nichols, a black man who died after a traffic stop earlier this month. Five police officers were fired last week and charged with second-degree murder and other offenses yesterday. At a vigil for Nichols last night, his stepfather, Rodney Wells, urged people not to react with violence.
We do not want any type of uproar. We do not want any type of disturbance. We want peaceful protests.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre also called on policymakers to embrace reforms like the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which would make it easier to prosecute police officers for misconduct. The legislation was passed in the House but has not cleared the Senate. And in international news, a Palestinian gunman opened fire at a Jerusalem synagogue today, killing at least seven people and injuring others in what Israeli authorities called a terrorist attack. They say the shooter was killed at the scene. The attack comes amid heightened tensions in the region. Yesterday, a raid by Israeli forces in the West Bank Palestinian city of Jenin left nine dead, including at least one civilian, Palestinian officials said. It was the deadliest Israeli operation in the West Bank in recent years. Coming up, hundreds of prisons and jails are treating inmates' drug addictions with medication. We'll visit some of the programs that have seen early successes after the break.
Planes powered by GE Aerospace Technology take off every 2 seconds, and nearly 3 billion people flew last year with our technology under wing. By empowering the brightest minds, GE Aerospace is reimagining engine design and advanced aircraft systems. developing hybrid electric engines, and technologies compatible with alternative fuels like sustainable aviation fuel. GE Aerospace strives every day to invent the future of flight, lift people up, and bring them home safely.
The opioid crisis has taken a heavy toll across the U.S. In 2021, drug fatalities reached a record of more than 108,000, and the ravages of drug addiction are acutely apparent in the nation's jails and prisons. Roughly two-thirds of people entering these facilities have what the Department of Health and Human Services diagnoses as substance use disorder. Now, a growing number of jails and prisons are trying a new approach, dispensing anti-addiction medications to inmates in the hopes of setting them on the path to sobriety. The programs are showing early success, but they also raise a controversial question. Can drugs treat addiction? As part of a Wall Street Journal series on the opioid epidemic, our health and medicine reporter Julie Wernow visited some of the jails trying out these programs, and she joins me now. Julie, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, Julie, you visited a few jails with these types of programs. Tell us about some of the places you went to.
I went to Middlesex County, Massachusetts, where I met Sheriff Peter Cotugin, who started a drug treatment program there several years ago to treat people with opioid addiction in jail, mostly because he wasn't seeing very much treatment of addiction inside prisons and jails and wanted to make a change. And what Sheriff Cotugin quickly found is that there were challenges to starting a program inside a jail or a prison.
When I became sheriff, I knew that medication-assisted treatment was a big ask. It was a major cultural shift, and I knew that the industry and the communities were not ready for it.
The thing is that inside corrections, people most associate these medications with contraband that inmates trade among themselves illegally. Another factor is that many people in corrections believe that treating drugs with drugs isn't the way to go. There's a stigma attached to that, and many believe that the only way to treat addiction is for people to remove drugs entirely from their lives. But ultimately, the impact of treating these inmates with these medications spoke for itself, and it wasn't as difficult to make that cultural shift anymore.
So how exactly does this work, Julie?
So people come into the jail and they are evaluated right away for opioid addiction. And if it's determined that medication might be appropriate, it's really up to the inmate to decide to opt in to this kind of treatment. And the treatment might include a daily medication, which could include buprenorphine, which tamps down cravings for opioids, naloxone, which actually reverses their effects and makes it impossible for someone to get high, and methadone, which can ease withdrawal symptoms and is also an opioid itself. These drugs are highly regulated, and so you have people getting their mouths checked. They have to sit there so that they make sure that the drug fully dissolves, that they're not using it as contraband. And some drugs are actually given as extended release shots, where they only take that drug once a month. And those are treatments that can be also extended to the outside once they're released.
So, Julie, you spoke to people who are in programs like this, and you met two women at another jail with a similar program. Tell us about them.
That's right. I went to Allegheny County Detention Center in Cumberland, Maryland, where I met with Morgan Grubb and Belen Waybright. There are two friends who actually met in this kind of program, and they both had similar paths and challenges. Morgan spoke about some of those challenges that she faced in getting clean.
The program for me has been, honestly, it's changed my life, to be completely honest. It really has. Like, I couldn't get away from the drugs. I couldn't. Because the dependence on it, just physically, everything, mentally, it was impossible. But since I've been on this box, and it's really, I'm normal, me again.
So that was Morgan. As for Belen, she's had many years of challenges with substance use. She actually even ran away from a previous program. But this one was really working for her.
Like, when you haven't worked on your feelings and, like, stuff that you've been through in your life, like trauma and everything, you're not yourself because you've let the drugs consume who they were. So, like, it basically made everything that was broken fix. Mm. And it is, like, a love affair that can a body break? You know, it's like you're married to it.
I spoke to both these women shortly before they were released from jail. They had a plan to go together to continue their treatment and continue the medication that they were taking.
Julie, how did Morgan and Belen do outside of jail once they were released?
When we spoke to Morgan, she was doing very well. She'd continued with the medication after she was released, and she was actually even able to host her son's birthday party. She was just so happy about the way things had gone. When I caught up with Belen again this week, on the other hand, she'd had a death in her family, had gone back to using, ended up back in jail. And now she is back on the program and the medication. The thing is, in Belen's case, the medication may have saved her life. She may not have entirely gotten off drugs, but it allowed her to try again to end her substance use. And sometimes it takes several tries for a person to really stay off drugs. Back in Middlesex County, where Sheriff Katujan is, Louis Diaz, who's in recovery himself, helps bridge the gap between jail and those who are now back in the real world outside. He told me that people will come to jail addicted and broken, and if they have a chance on the outside, it will be because someone's there to hold their hand and help them get back on their feet. Without that, he said, being released can actually be the most dangerous time for a former drug user.
I remember guys leaving here. I have stories of 8 hours out there and dead, 24 hours. So that used to break my heart because guys were leaving here without having the methadone or Suboxone or Vivitrol or the services that we provide now.
Former prisoners are 40 times more likely than the general population to die of an overdose, according to a study in the American Journal of Public Health. And more than 2/3 of prisoners are rearrested within 3 years of release. Half of them end up incarcerated again, according to the Department of Health and Human Services. So that 24 hours after a person is released is absolutely critical.
So, Julie, given these results, what are the hopes of people who started programs like this? Are they hoping they will expand to other locations and keep going? What did you hear?
Well, to put this into context, 8 years ago, there were only 22 of these programs in all of the country. Now there is more than 600, and most of those just popped up in the last 2 years. And many more are on their way because of litigation and laws that have passed in various states saying that essentially not treating prisoners this way is inhumane. In Middlesex County, with Sheriff Katujan, what they've seen is about 98% of the inmates who participated in the program were alive 6 months after release. And recidivism among the group is 1/3 of the rate for other inmates. Now that Peter Katujan has been able to see so much success among his inmates and former inmates as a result of treating their opioid addiction, he's become a kind of evangelist for these kinds of programs. He travels all around the country answering questions from sheriff's departments, prison leadership, about how they too can get these kinds of programs off the ground. And what leadership in jails and prisons who have tried this kind of treatment are saying is that this isn't just a testing ground for inmates. This should be a testing ground for the fact that medication does work to treat people, whether you're in jail or not.
One of the greatest catastrophes about this is the fact that we know what will work, but you shouldn't have to come to jail to get good programming or treatment. I've said this all the time. Like, I'm proud of this, but you shouldn't have to come to jail. You should be able to get this treatment and these resources in the community so you don't have to be justice involved.
And what addiction treatment experts say is that in order for these kinds of programs to be successful, they need to provide a warm handoff to resources in the community so that former inmates can continue their treatment for as long as they need to stay off drugs.
That's Wall Street Journal health and medicine reporter Julie Wernow. Julie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Biden administration has said it wants medications available for every drug user in federal custody and at half of state prisons and jails by 2025. Julie's story is part of a Wall Street Journal series on the opioid crisis in America. For more, visit WSJ.com. And finally, like we mentioned earlier, Americans are spending less these days. But all that cutting back and penny pinching is giving some shoppers the urge to splurge. In a January Morning Consult poll conducted for the Wall Street Journal, 3 in 10 American adults admitted to purchasing a luxury good in the past month. Our reporter Rachel Wolf calls it revenge inflation spending, where people purchase items they otherwise would not have.
It's not necessarily always the best financial decision, but it's what feels the best psychologically. And people feel like they really need the reminder that they still are leading a good life and have a good job. These are a lot of people whose salaries have not actually changed. They're middle-income folks who still have good jobs. It's just that their purchasing power, the amount that they're actually able to buy with their salary, has dramatically gone down.
You can hear more about revenge spending and how some consumers are looking to treat themselves on today's episode of our personal finance podcast, Your Money Briefing. And that's what's news for this week. Our hosts are me, Anne-Marie Fertoli, and Luke Vargas. The show was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé and Mohsen Ali, with help from Anthony Bansi, Kate Bullivant, Julie Chang, Daniela Cheslow, Zoe Culkin, Zoe Thomas, and J.R. Whalen. And editorial support from Alan Haberchak, Sandra Kilhoff, Michael Kosmides, Falana Patterson, and Chris Sinsley. If you like what you hear, please rate and review us. We'll be back on Monday morning. Thanks for listening.
Planes powered by GE Aerospace technology take off every 2 seconds, and nearly 3 billion people flew last year with our technology under wing. As a new independently traded company on the New York Stock Exchange, our purpose remains: invent the future of flight, lift people up, and bring them home safely.